Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Andrew Doyle, comedian, intellectual, social commentator, and politically rooted on the left, has written one of the most insightful and powerful critiques of what we've come to call wokery. In his book, The New Puritans, he writes, "The New Puritans is useful as a title, mostly because of what the concept of Puritanism has come to represent. Theirs is a belief in the perfectibility of humankind. The object is not to critique society as it is, but to engineer an entirely fresh pseudo-reality through the imposition of limitations on language, thought, and perception. They seek to publicly shame those they consider dissidents and condemn all those who stray from their righteous path." Well, there's a growing consensus that wokery constitutes effectively a new religion. It may consist of infantilized, immature, closed-minded, bitter fundamentalists who've succumbed to a form of mass hysteria, but they behave as though they're the practitioners of a new religion with a frighteningly demanding ethic at the centre. It's one from which, if you fail, there is no forgiveness. Your accountability lies more in the group you belong to than your own responsibility. And yet, paradoxically, at the same time, you can be publicly excommunicated if you're even suspected of an ethical thought crime. Their meanings and words that they use shift every so often, leaving anyone who wants to assess them with a rational and intellectual critique stumbling in a dark mist of contradiction and obfuscation. And although Andrew Doyle is an atheist, the Church has always needed keen intellectual atheists to offer a clinical critique of where religion goes bad. In conversation, I, as a Catholic, believe that the only long-term remedy for bad and misleading, dysfunctional, power-obsessed religion is good, truthful, enabling, compassion-centred religion, which is what Catholicism is at its best. Andrew, for good reasons, given his worldview, puts his faith in the Socratic method. But in everything else, we are agreed. And in this complex and deliberately deceitful world, we need a clear-eyed, well-informed, ethically well-tuned, intellectually astute guide. And Andrew Doyle is one of, if not the best. He joins me now. Andrew Doyle, fantastic to meet you. I feel like I know you. You're a kind of rock star of the intellectual non-left, and you've written this wonderful book which suggests that what we're facing is a new form of religion. And I don't think that many people understand quite what the implications of this are. So what I'm hoping I can do is ask you, first of all, to give a synopsis of your analysis, and then perhaps we can tease out some of the differences, for my sake, the pros and cons of what Catholicism might bring to the table, both good and bad, and from your position, above all, to see if there's where we can go in the face of what must be one of the most problematic cultural and intellectual critiques that civilization has faced. So, first of all, welcome and thank you for being here.
Thank you ever so much for having me. I do really appreciate it. First and foremost, I think that this movement that you describe is presenting particular problems because of the language it uses with which to describe itself. It sort of postures as a liberal, progressive movement for social justice and equality and anti-racism and all of these ideas, which all sound wonderful to anyone with any sort of ounce of humanity. But actually, the upshot of the movement is that it does precisely the opposite. It is illiberal. It is regressive. It creates a more racially divided society. It works against social justice. So it's very difficult, and people are confused by it. They don't understand why, because most people are generally liberal-minded, and most people want fairness, and they want to treat people well, irrespective of their race, gender, sexuality, creed, etc. And so when they hear a movement parroting these very appealing shibboleths and terms, then obviously that is attractive. And so therefore, in order to explain what's actually going on, you have to dig down into the language that they use and explain the situation and explain why it has a kind of unthinking quality. It relies on the complete abandonment of critical thinking. And therefore, I use the idea in the book of a religion. I call it the religion of social justice. And the reason I do that is, well, there's a number of reasons. One of which is it's an analogy to try and make sense of it all. Insofar as, I suppose what I'm really implying there is it's a fundamentalist kind of religion. It's a religion that brooks no dissent, that sort of says, that reduces the world to this very simplistic binary of good and evil and situates itself on the side of the good, and will damn and condemn and utterly destroy anyone who it perceives to be a heretic. It has some qualities of fundamentalist religions insofar as it will excommunicate members of its own team if they are perceived to be impure. And that word purity, I think, is important because it does postulate a kind of, or demand a kind of moral purity. And that's why I call the book The New Puritans. I'm talking about a group of people who have a notion of moral purity and seek to impose it on anyone else through authoritarian means.
Isn't it the case that one could argue that sociologically, philosophically, human beings are they're inclined to want to be religious, if only because, as you say, mm. we're all quite good-natured, we'd like things to be made better. And whether or not people do the whole metaphysical joining of dots from what they want pragmatically and politically to what might exist beyond time and space to give them an ethical mandate for it, whether they think of that or not, there's a kind of instinct to do religion. And if you're not doing religion properly, isn't this an example of doing religion badly, flooding into the gap? I mean, it's Chesterton, isn't it, who is attributed to saying, you know, if you don't believe in God, you believe in anything. And if there wasn't a God, we'd have to invent him. Do you accept or do you have a better explanation?
I don't have an explanation as far as I don't know the answer to that question, but I am mostly persuaded. There have been a lot of people who've put forward this idea that wokeism is occupying a gap that has been created by the decline of institutional religion. A lot of people have posited that actually wokeism can only exist with the precedent of Christianity. Specifically, Tom Holland makes that argument in his book Dominion, where he talks about Christ and the figure of the victim, the ultimate symbol of the crucifix, of one who triumphs through suffering, and that has somehow laid the groundwork for wokeist belief, which is why you get this this need to almost identify oneself into a victim class. I don't know the answer, but I would say there is a certain religiosity, though, which is undeniable. Certainly what I would call a religious fervor with the way that the activists behave, the self-styled social justice activists. And it does make sense of it if you think of it in those terms, if you think of it as a religion, insofar as it's a group of people who aren't really thinking for themselves. They're following a creed, a script. They're following a set of rules or guidelines that has been preordained. And that, I suppose, is the hallmark of any ideology. But the reason why I make the distinction between religion and fundamentalist religion is that, of course, as you will know, within Catholicism, there are all sorts of theological arguments and disputes going on. It's endless, and it is encouraged, in fact. That's not what you get in a cult. That's not what you get in a fundamentalist cult, is it? You get a kind of charismatic leader who imposes the rules. And we've got the same thing here. We've got a number of charismatic leaders who sort of impose what it is you're meant to think. And it seems to, I mean, I don't know how many conversations you've had with those who have been completely captured by this cult. But once someone uses one of the phrases, one of their sort of esoteric, their in phrases, like toxic masculinity or cis heteronormativity or whatever, you know, those phrases, I will know their opinion on every single subject. I've never been proven wrong on this because they're not thinking for themselves. They are following a script. That to me means that it is a negation of the individual. To be part of it, to surrender yourself entirely to an ideology is to give up on yourself as a human being, as a thinking human being. That to me is frightening. I see it as a form of intellectual death. And that to me makes sense if we see it in those terms as a religion. But what I'm not trying to do is malign religion per se. I'm talking very specifically about what you just outlined, the idea of of those who would outsource their moral agency to someone else. And I suppose it's easier, isn't it? I don't suppose it's just about religion. I mean, we know and studies show that we are given to lazy thinking. If there is a simple solution, our minds will find that more alluring straight away. It's a thing called the cognitive miser model. Quite natural for us to find the easiest solution possible. And what could be easier than outsourcing your decision-making to someone else or this idea of what is right and wrong, just someone else decides for you. I think that's what's going on here. But I also think what's going on is a kind of hysteria. I think I should make that clear. I call it the New Puritans because I wanted to draw a very direct line to the precedent of what happened in Salem, Massachusetts, because I see so many comparisons there. But maybe we can talk about that in a bit.
No, that's fascinating. I mean, there are a number of books which have documented moments of religious hysteria in European history, which are unbelievably weird. One wouldn't think rational people were capable of groupthink, group behaving the way they are. I think the psychologists often, in my judgment, offer us some of the most useful insights, because they have a notion of developmental maturity. And one of the early stages, just pre-adolescence and early adolescence, is when you outsource authority unthinkingly to some form of heroic icon, totem, whatever. And for a while, and this is where all fundamentalism stems from psychologically, that you simply delegate all authority and all virtue to them. And if you begin to think that, it seriously undermines the structures of your own personality, which is why it's so frightening and terrifying to do it, until some level of maturity is stimulated by some catalyst, and you begin to move through it, though not everyone does. But of course, there are a number of different models. I think the psychological maturation one is just one, but undoubtedly people are stuck in a stage of outsourced authority fundamentalism. And as you quite rightly say, combined with a kind of social hysteria, which I guess has been provided by the internet.
But that's interesting that you talk about that development psychologically, because I do see this movement, and indeed the culture war generally, as being mass infantilism, as being a kind of world collective arrested development.
Yeah,
you see it all the time in the disputes online, which have now seeped over into parliament and into major commentators, is that this tendency to interpret any slight point of disagreement as evidence of evil, as evidence of malevolence, and that sort of lack of generosity in interpretation strikes me as fundamentally childish. But also to assume that anyone who thinks differently from you must be doing so from a point of evil or stupidity, again, is infantile. So I think we are dealing with children. We're dealing with children in adults' bodies now. I think that's what's happening. And of course, children are more susceptible to this kind of hysteria. This is why, if we take the example of Salem, if I just explain roughly where I'm coming from there, is that in Salem, it was the girls, it was the children of the village, you know, and this is late 17th century, so it's and it lasted for only a little over a year, you know. And this is something I really make clear in the book. These were not witch burners. The people of Salem were decent, God-fearing folk who didn't go around accusing people of witchcraft. This wasn't their thing. This, you know, it happened an awful lot in Europe. It didn't happen very much with the Puritans of New England. And they found themselves, these girls started saying that various people in the village were in league with the devil, that they'd seen them sign the devil's book, etc., and so on and so on. And there are all sorts of theories as to why that was that have been posited by all sorts of experts. We don't know whether they were genuinely seeing these visions or whether there was an element of dissemblance going on here. We just don't know. But what we do know is that it would not have persisted for a year. It only lasted for a year. It would not have persisted unless the figures of authority in the village capitulated. I see this very much as similar to what's happening now. Back then, all of the 20 people who were executed in Salem were done so on the basis of what they call spectral evidence. In other words, the girls' testimony, what we call lived experience. The girls said they saw these things. That was their lived experience. That was their truth. And therefore, that was taken as evidence that it was real. And the reason why Salem fell apart is because eventually one of the local magistrates contacted the leading clergyman in the country and said, and asked them, is spectral evidence admissible in court? And they said, no. They said, not at all. And that was it. And that was it over. So I see the girls of Salem, the ones pointing and screaming witch, as the activists of today online, the anime avatars, pointing and screaming Nazi, fascist, TERF, homophobe, transphobe, racist, all of these phrases, which are the modern day equivalent of witch, and they don't require evidence for their claims. The assertion is taken as proof. And that's the same as Salem. But it would go away. It wouldn't matter if you had all these people online calling everyone Nazis who disagreed with them. If the politicians and the media class and the managerial class and the corporate class and all of these sort of major establishment figures didn't go along with it. But they do. They are complicit. And that's why the hysteria has been allowed to spread. That's my feeling about it. And that's why I wanted to draw the comparison with Salem, because I think that's there's maybe an accessible way of understanding what's happening here, is that the children are in charge, basically.
That's very helpful, because the grown-ups have given up. There aren't any grown-ups in the room. One is the whole fashion of postmodernism, which has removed any scaffolding for offering empirical testing of any kind. So the relativism of the emotionalism of the adolescent is unchallengeable. The other, I think, is a huge climate of fear for a number of reasons, economically, pandemic, ecologically, above all. Fear is being pumped into the system all the time. And so it seems to me acting as a kind of fuel for the hysteria.
Fear mattered an awful lot in Salem as well, because, of course, anyone who tried to defend the women or men who were being accused were they themselves accused subsequently. So yeah. The fear of being hanged was very real. And we have a similar thing now. We have the fear of cancel culture, because that's the activists I'm talking about are scary people. They are vicious because they don't perceive you as a human being. If you disagree with them, they don't treat you as a human being, and they lack. So from our perspective, it looks like they completely lack compassion or basic human empathy. They think that those are their greatest virtues, but they have neither. So fear is really important in understanding this. Intimidation. To give a very obvious example, when you ask a politician today, what is a woman? You can see the fear in their eyes, and you can see as they stumble and obfuscate and tried not to answer. We know they know the answer, and they know that we know that they know the answer. So it can only be fear that is preventing them from speaking. It's a very powerful tool. It's why bullies often prevail.
And the dominoes seem to be falling in a way one wouldn't have expected. I was astonished when I read in your book that you assess that only 13% of the population, or in any segment of age, is actually committed to wokery ideologically. We know, I think it's well documented, I think the Nazis reached something like 9% of the population. And it's assumed that politically speaking, if in the population you get 9% of political activists, there's a very real chance you might capture the democracy. So in that context, 13% isn't a bad number. But this isn't a single political movement. This is a cultural fixation. It's still incredible to me that when grown-ups do try and stand up, like the wonderful Kathleen Stock from Sussex University, or J.K. Rowling, or you find them, unless they're very rich or very well protected, simply being buried under an avalanche of ethical condemnation.
Yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it, that it takes, and this is why when I wrote the book, I wanted it to be accessible above all things, because it takes an image or a moment which is completely clear. There's a moment of pure clarity for the cards to fall. I mean, you know, you're talking about a postmodernist movement that doesn't have the scaffolding of truth. But of course, there's always the hard brick wall of reality that you will eventually run into. A lot of the situation with Kathleen Stock and people who have spoken about this is that a lot of people just didn't understand it. You know, they didn't understand. They were told that these academics were being hateful and bigoted. And so, yes, they understand why there's protests and why they're being driven out. They don't really look into it any more than that. But when you have the case of Isla Bryson or Adam Graham, the rapist who now identifies as a woman in Scotland, and you can see this is a scary man with a neck tattoo who has raped women, who now has a terrible blonde wig on and has made no effort at all to look female, and is being housed, remanded in a woman's prison by the Scottish state. And then there's another one of the most terrifying prisoners, I can't remember the name, now goes by the name as Tiffany, who is so violent, has been known to bite open his own veins and spray his people with blood in prisons when they try and withhold him. That, you know, you're dealing with some of these, and then suddenly you're told the Scottish state is going to put those people in prison, and already does so. I think for a long time people didn't think that was happening, for one thing. Then things change, and now in a matter of weeks, in this country only really, but in a matter of weeks, politicians have stopped saying phrases like "trans women are women." I don't know if you've noticed. Which was a mantra they went to. It won't cut ice anymore now. It's things like the swimmer, Leah Thomas, you know, this very tall, muscular bloke who went from being ranked number 590th or something in the swimming league, suddenly says he's a woman, he's number one. Overnight, number one. And he's not had any surgery. He has male genitals. He's unchanging women's changing rooms. And you see that photograph of him towering on the winner's podium over these over women, and suddenly it changes. The public are like, hang on a minute, that's obviously unfair.
let's just because we're accumulating evidence, I think, for Fight Back or for the breakthrough of reality. And I don't want to lose this because, you know, although we probably ought to keep it to the end, it's such an important part of the conversation. So, I mean, for a lot of people, watching Nicola Sturgeon tie herself in knots, you know, there are three sexes, men, women, and rapists in prison. And that began to look so ridiculous that even the general public got the ideological stupidity of that. So then there's women in sport and a few brave sport officials not willing to destroy the whole of women's sport. And then there's GB News. I don't want to turn this into a kind of big fanzine thing, but you're about the only people in the public media, at least in our culture, giving a platform for people to give the other side. I mean, quite rightly, you offer both sides, but you're the only people giving the other side. So I mean, we've just plucked out a couple. Do you think there's going to be enough momentum to take some of the steam out of the hysteria and allow some form of empirical common sense sanity back in, enough so that the grown-ups get a bit of courage?
I think so. I mean, the problem is, you know, I've been covering this stuff for almost 2 years on GB News, inviting feminists on to express their views and indeed inviting the activists on to express theirs. I do want to hear both sides. But like you say, we're the only news channel that has done so. And one of the reasons for that is, as I go, you know, I talk in the book about institutional capture. This is a movement that has captured all of our major institutions. And yes, that does include the BBC, but it also includes every major news channel, all the media. It includes all the arts in particular. They are completely captured. And so therefore, there's been a very concerted effort to attempt to demonize GB News precisely for hearing those other voices that you don't normally get to hear. And it's been, you know, it has to a degree been successful. You know, we had an advertising boycott that, you know, we had these activists saying it was going to be a far-right echo chamber 4 months before it had even aired. And then when it did air, and it clearly wasn't that, you hear on any given program on GB News, you will hear different viewpoints on the same subject. But the critics don't watch the channel. They just cherry-pick elements that they've seen shared online that they object to. But if you have a channel that's devoted to free speech, you're bound to find clips that you object to. That's the thing. But what's happened since the Scottish incident a few weeks ago is now, even in the mainstream establishment media, even on the BBC, even on ITV, you're starting to hear journalists, reporters asking the difficult questions of politicians regarding gender ideology. That is a huge step forward. I like to think we've made some difference there, but I don't know if we have. But I think just giving people the voice, saying that the conversation can occur and conducting that conversation in an adult way, I think that's the way forward. And hopefully that is contagious, the idea of engaging with these things in a rational way when they see it can be done. You know, I mean, I had a few weeks ago, I had a trans activist barrister and another barrister who, as it comes from a gender critical feminist perspective, sit down and have a conversation. And no one was shouting and no one was calling each other TERF or Nazi or any all the other stuff. And it was really effective and interesting. And it, you know, if we'd have been doing that 4 years ago, you know, we might have avoided all of these issues. We might have made so much more progress. But as it is, we didn't. The establishment was captured before people realized what was happening. And so now we are in damage limitation mode, and we are trying to unpick all of this damage that has been done. The terrible things that have happened at the Tavistock Clinic. There's now, of course, a book that's come out revealing the extent of it. We've been talking about this for a long time, but people haven't been listening, that effectively the Tavistock Clinic has been fixing medically people who are very likely to grow up gay. It has been medicalizing and sterilizing kids who just don't happen to conform to gender stereotypes. Now we see it collapsing, and now we see the damage that has been done. Now we're getting more and more people who are detransitioning and coming out and saying, some of these kids, they had one face-to-face appointment and they're on puberty blockers, even though the CAS report has shown that puberty blockers are not safe. You know, this is incredible. You would never have guessed it, would you? I think 10, 15 years ago, if I'd have thought we would live in a state that had a NHS-funded body that was sterilising and medicalising homosexuality, I really would not have believed that.
Part of my problem is that I'm, you know, I wonder if it's because I'm getting old and sclerotic in my head, but I'm simply feeling numb. I find it almost impossible. to believe that this has happened, and I'm assuming it's a failure of my intellectual imagination. It might be, but it's obviously more than that. It's the scale of what's going on. So we've got the. It's immensely hopeful that the Tavistock book has been written and that people are writing about it. This feels a bit like the sturgeon and the rapist in the jail, like a tipping moment, maybe. You've got, you hope that the Socratic method, people, sensible people talking down, non-demonizing kind of way, will be enough. My view is a bit more radical than that. I don't expect you to agree with this, but I want to put it out there nonetheless. I think that part of this is the fault of the Christian Church for rolling over in front of the. I mean, it's experienced some really terrible assaults for 150 years. Some of them deserved, most of them undeserved. But nonetheless, the assault's been unremitting, and it's rolled over and decided to define and understand itself in terms of its critics, which is stupid. But it's done that, and it's left this enormous vacuum at a time of immense existential need when we've set out. Huxley-like, just to entertain people into a mode of idiocy. But one of the reasons I'm a Catholic, I think this can only ultimately be solved by giving people a good religion back. But part of the problem is that there are no serious religious voices. I mean, I yearn nostalgically, almost infantile, like almost in an infantile way, for a JP2. You know, someone, a grown-up in the room, to stand up and say, actually, you're not delivering the goods you say you're going to be. This way we'll do it.
Yeah.
But we still have a completely kneecapped or debilitated moral leadership within the Christian community. And however much dear Tom Holland says everyone's swimming in the Christian goldfish bowl, there are no trusted voices making their way through the hysteria and the fog.
One of the things that has surprised me most is the susceptibility of, for instance, the Church of England to wokeism.
Yeah.
And actually, it's not just the Church of England. I spoke to a gentleman from America who's from the Evangelical Baptist tradition. He says the Baptist Church has been captured to a degree. And they're talking about, they run now workshops on Jesus Christ as an intersectional figure in the Bible. I mean, you know, even what you would consider to be some of the more fervent Christian bodies are not immune. This is, I think, a kind of unprecedented movement because it seems to find its tentacles in everywhere. And to be immune to its poisons is very difficult.
One of the things I've seen happening over the last 20 years, which surprised me immensely, was the way in which even evangelical Protestants, even American evangelical Protestants, who are normally we hold out to be the most closed-minded and bigoted of all religious creatures, dear friends, but nonetheless, to watch them lose their epistemological moorings, because in the end, everything they did was based on a level of personal judgment. And whilst that was rooted in a kind of sane collective, once the sane collective got infiltrated or infected by this meme, nothing was safe anymore. And the Catholic Church, I'm not boasting about it in a partisan way. I wouldn't want to be stupid enough to do that. The Catholic Church is in the middle of a very, very serious civil war in which the Pope sits on the fence in the civil war, which makes it much more complicated. And my sense is that if the Catholic Church gives way in this, then the whole of Western culture is lost, because I can't think of any other agency that would have the epistemological bottom or foundation or weight to offer people something with a gravitational force that would balance what's taking place. Now, that's my own personal point of view, and I don't want to impose on anyone. It's just one of the reasons why I found myself where I am. But I go on thinking that however attracted I am to your Socratic method, because, of course, I'm part of the Western educated tradition, I just worry it's not enough. So I'm very pleased at the idea we might have tipping points of epistemologically verifiable reality in the media.
I think what has happened with Scotland shows that those tipping points do in fact exist. Well, it remains to be seen whether this momentum can continue. And the other thing to remember, of course, is that the pushback that we've seen from rationalists in this country, well, we're the minority. You know, they call us Turf Island. You know, America is completely captured. Canada's gone. Ireland is gone. Most of these other countries. I mean, you try explaining to people in Ireland that you shouldn't have male rapists in women's prisons. They won't go for it. You know, they are completely gone. And Canada as well. And so, but I think it could be that the UK becomes like a beacon of reason when it comes to this issue, and it does spread. And I've seen some evidence that it is. But yeah, when it comes to the Socratic method, I mean, this is actually, I do argue in the book, though, that you need to reserve your energies for those who are still capable of argumentation. And I'm not in a position to de-radicalize anyone. And therefore, I'm not going to sit down and try and persuade the most extreme social justice activists, the ones that see Nazism everywhere, the ones that genuinely think we're living through the Fourth Reich. You know, they are fantasists, and you can't reason with a fantasist. And as I say, because they do represent a statistical minority, we can win this culture war by simply limiting our attention to those who are still capable of argument, which is the majority of people. And the majority of people just haven't really grasped what this movement is about. There's a lot of fellow travellers who, if they fully comprehended what the movement was about, they would not in any way support it. And so it's quite simply a matter, I think, of communicating the problem better. That's why I wrote the book. I want people who don't know much about the culture war to read the book and to understand what it's about so that they can reach a reasonable conclusion and not be carried away in the tide of hysteria. And that, I think, is how we can, that's how we can win it.
The book is marvellous, and you know, one of the reasons why I'm so grateful you've come on the programme is that anything we can do to make the book more accessible is excellent. But the fact is, although, I mean, I've been reading and thinking in this area for a while, the ideas are really quite hard to grasp, beginning with the fact that nobody can agree on a name for it. And as you say within the book, it took a very long time whilst we were talking of the culture wars, because the first thing the left said, well, there aren't any. And then we said, well, it's neo-Marxism. And they said, no, it's not. You don't understand Marxism. There are no economics in this at all, which, of course, was true. But that wasn't the point of calling it neo-Marxism. I mean, it's only very recently that the rude word woke has become useful and available to us. But it's a bit late. And not many people understand them, but they don't understand it. Again, we can argue about whether the extent to which the Frankfurt School are consciously constructors of much of this, or unconsciously, or not at all. But the fact that you have to argue about the Frankfurt School is going to leave a lot of people out in the cold.
The added problem, which I talk about in the book as well, as you'll recall, is that whenever we do get a phrase to describe this movement, disciples of the movement will problematize the phrase and smear anyone who uses the term. In other words, they don't want to have some way to describe them. So we've had this again and again. The phrase cultural Marxism was a perfectly legitimate phrase which was used to describe the cultural turn of the Marxist movement away from money and economics towards identity. And this was a term that was used completely innocuously by many academics. And then it started to be used by some pretty vile anti-Semites. And so now the term cultural Marxism can't really be used without the connotations of anti-Semitism and conspiratorial thinking. So that makes it difficult, because then, okay, well, then that we can't use that phrase anymore, because I don't want anyone to think I'm an anti-Semite. So what do I use? Then you get the phrase woke, which was the way in which these activists described themselves for many years. Let's not forget that. It was their chosen term of self-identification. But then, of course, comedians and people like me, I suppose, started using the word about them to describe them, and often in a mocking way or in a way that suggests we didn't agree with them. And they started to think, oh, well, we've got to now problematize the word. So all of a sudden, we heard this narrative that the word woke had been invented by the right as a snarl word, a way to smear the left. So then all of a sudden, whenever you hear the word woke, you start thinking, oh, that's a right-wing reactionary bigot. You know, and these are all very clever and deliberate ploys, because it means you've got no way to describe the enemy that you're attempting to engage with. I think there isn't a better term than woke at the moment. Our job is made a whole lot harder whenever you get extremists on the right who are using these terms. As I said, we saw it with cultural Marxism, we see it with woke. When these sort of lumbering halfwits come into the debate, there are some pretty nasty bigots who do despise gay people and black people, and they will rail against the woke and everything. But it's so hard then, because then when we use the term, when rational, decent people use the term to try and describe this very serious existential problem, it's very easy to lump them in with these extreme people. So it's very hard. It's very hard. But I think we do need a word to describe them. And at the moment, that's all we have.
I don't want to slip into despair, but a microcosm of that was the Tate Gallery the other day, where you had a number of people standing outside saying, please don't sexualize our children. By all means, have drag artists, but have them in clubs or in a sensible mode in pantomime. But this is something altogether different. And then you only need one group of thugs and the whole thing then becomes delegitimized.
That's an excellent example. I mean, drag, I have absolutely no problem with drag. I've seen many, many drag shows, but drag shows are adult shows.
Sure.
They are designed for adults. The whole art form is rooted in sexuality, and there's nothing wrong with that for adult entertainment. But more than that, the books that the drag queens are reading out to these children are ideological instruction manuals. They are essentially attempts at indoctrination. And that's not what art should be about. So I don't know what the Tate are doing. It's certainly not what education should be about. So I don't know what libraries and schools are doing. So there are really, really legitimate reasons to protest against drag queen story hour. But of course, a man in a dress is going to raise the ire of people who want to beat up men in dresses or people who don't conform to gender stereotypes. And so therefore, it will also attract those kinds of people. But that doesn't mean that the principle of objecting to drag queen story hour is wrong just because a few unpleasant people support it. Similarly, there are some very, very nasty people on the far right who support free speech or say that they do because they want to be able to say some of the most appalling things imaginable. That doesn't mean just because some unpleasant people support free speech doesn't mean that the principle of free speech is tainted and therefore wrong. And I think we need to be very clear about that, and sort of, which is also why I think there's kind of a responsibility for people on the liberal side of this to condemn and be consistent, to say, no, that you know, the woke are wrong, they are authoritarian, oppose authoritarianism wherever it stands, in other words, and that includes on the far right as well as the far left. I think that would be the way forward.
So the woke have got a number of extremely clever ploys, changing language the moment we get hold of it, and then guilt by association, which is almost impossible to shake off, whether it's legitimate association or legitimate association. But to cheer ourselves up, so I think the Catholic Church, if you could only come good and find it and grow a pair of something or other, would be good. But the other thing that works extremely well is Titania McGrath. So humour is one of the major weapons in our armoury. And astonishingly, you've proved to be just brilliant at it. So tell us about Titania McGrath and whether or not you think the principle can be extended anyway, apart from people tweeting her genius at every opportune moment.
So Titania McGrath was an attempt, I suppose, to take the satirical angle towards these problems, because I think satire can be an effective tool to expose the absurdities of certain ideas. Satire is about, you know, mocking the powerful, and I perceive the social justice movement, or what I call the critical social justice movement, to be an extremely powerful force in our society. It's very much about punching up at the establishment. That's what the Titania McGrath is. Really, what it is about my hatred of bullies. I do not like bullies, and I think that you need to mock them. So that's why I did it. But whether it's been effective, I don't know. It gets them very angry, that's for sure. Some people have told me it's been effective. I've had some people get in touch and say that it was Titania that almost de-radicalized them, which I find very flattering. So it seems to have made a difference in some cases. And also just, it's kind of, because no one was really attacking that. You know, there were a few, of course, who I greatly admired, but not many comedians were going after this target because it's captured the comedy industry so completely. Those of us who mock this movement are considered pariahs, and we are. You know, I'm absolutely hated by most comedians, and by doing it, it gives others permission. It's like, no, it's okay. We can, you know, comedians are able to mock everything, or we should be able to mock absolutely everything. And so to mock this movement that has sort of ring-fenced itself from criticism, I think a lot of people found a great relief. But then, you know, I've kind of taken a two-pronged attack on this. The one side has been satirical through Titania or through my stand-up, but the other side has been through writing about it in a very serious way, because I think we have to treat it seriously as well. And I don't know which approach is more effective. Maybe one approach is better than the other in certain cases, but I think both have value. You know, I am a comedian. I come from that background, so I will probably always, my instinct will always be to mock folly where I see it, but I think also being clear about where I stand and what I think has been quite important, because a lot of people have been determined to misrepresent or misunderstand the Titania character as being my attempt to mock minorities, which of course is the opposite of what it is. I think that's probably a willful misinterpretation, because I think you have to be a little bit stupid to think that.
No, of course it's willful, because what humour does, well, one of the things that some humour does is to attack those who have power. So that's why you're using it against bullies. It's the one thing that can bring a bully down. And you don't use humor against minorities because it's no longer humor at that point. It's a form of oppressive ridicule. So anyone can tell the difference in ridicule and humor. Titania is immensely humorous and is therefore a means of dealing with the improper power exercised by these people. And one of the reasons why it's so powerful and does de-radicalize people is because, in a way that's just pure genius, you expose the absurdity of it. The only way it can be successful is by persuading us that it's coherent and cogent. You can only argue against it if you're at least as up to speed as the proponents of the arguments, which not everyone is, but everybody can spot absurdity. So essentially what you do through Titania is you give everybody a weapon for analysing and deconstructing the absurdity that lies within the whole woke movement. It's immensely powerful. I mean, again, I see humour on one hand and an alternative better religion. I mean, one of the reasons why I think the Catholic Church should step up to the line is because it philosophically, theologically, existentially, it contains some hugely important antidotes. So, you know, the individual rather than the group, forgiveness rather than perpetual guilt, for forgiveness as opposed to accusation, and above all, joy, love and peace rather than anxiety, fear and threat. So again, I see the woke movement as being bad religion that has slipped into this vacuum. And clearly what we need is we need several prongs. We need a proper religion to stand up and say, look, this is what good utopian instinct feels like. We need comedians to say this is absurd, you mustn't believe it. And we need the Socratic method, the intellectuals, the commentators to say, we want to set you up a decent dialogue so you can choose between what you're being given. But there aren't many comedians. The Socratic people have lost courage and the church has somehow just not turned up.
Yeah, I mean, just look at what happened the other day. A comedian called Samantha Presti wrote an article for the comedy industry website called Chortle. And she talked about how she's leaving the comedy industry because it's full of wimps who won't say what they think. But she also talked about how she had been ostracized for saying that women deserve their own spaces in certain circumstances. And she's had a barrage of abuse. And her last ever show, which was booked at the Leicester Comedy Festival this week, was cancelled by the venue. Okay. Because we're almost deliberately, it seems like they were proving her point right there. But that's the industry we exist in. You know, and I think a lot of comedians are clearly, and I've learned, are cowards. And are very much not in it for comedy, for the vocation of comedy, but for something else, probably fame and money, I imagine, or whatever it might be. I don't proclaim to know. But they're certainly not prepared to stick their necks out. Although there's a good opportunity there for comedians, actually, because there are so few comics, because the industry itself frowns upon you if you try and take a contrary view, because criticism has been captured as well. I can't think of any comedy critics who aren't ideologically captured by this at the moment, or at least know that they have to posture in that way. Venues and promoters, all the same. We had Jerry Sadowitz's show cancelled at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and the venue itself said that the opinions he expressed on stage do not align with their values. Well, an arts venue, for the biggest arts festival in the world, the values should extend to promoting a variety of acts, and that's it, and not censoring them or attempting to police what they can and cannot say. And also, if a comedy promoter thinks that a comedian on stage telling jokes is the same as someone expressing opinions, then they don't understand comedy and shouldn't be in the business at all. But again, these are people who are prioritizing ideology over anything else. Yeah, it's very, very sad. How do we push back comedically when the gatekeepers of the industry are saying, if you do that, you're not going to get on TV, you're not going to get rebooked. It's very difficult. And people, I suppose, do have to make a living.
You're right that there are cowards everywhere, but then not everyone is in a position to show economic bravery. It's not bravery to allow people to take your income away so you can't feed your kids and pay your mortgage. So
No, but that's why I draw a distinction. My frustration is with those comedians who are really established. And they know that I'm right about this, but they won't say it. That bothers me. Why not? What you know, a bit of principle wouldn't go amiss.
You're absolutely right, but you've shown it, and so I mean we've come to the end probably what people can listen to in patience. Andrew, thank you for your courage, for your sense of humor. Thank you for taking the trouble to write the book. Thank you for Titania McGrath. Thank you for what you do in the public space on GB News, and we're incredibly grateful. Thank you too for explaining, making the whole thing accessible to people today. It's been really great to have you on the show and exceptionally nice to get to know you, and so God bless you, God keep you, and keep on with the struggle.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.